Manadu is simply a word referring to spirit, and it's a general word that means any type of spirit. One is expected, if you wish to delineate, one is expected to append a word that will delineate what type of spirit.
The other thing is that ought to be told is the Anishinaabeg hold that there are two souls within a human.
No, I don't agree to that. I mean, you say they do, but I don't think so.
In our discussions, though, you talked about the soul of the first consciousness and the soul of the second consciousness.
Well, it talked about the state of the first consciousness.
Okay.
We do believe, I mean, I know what gives rise to that, if you want me to say it.
Sure.
Missionaries wrote that down, and so of course it's read by everyone and everybody believes it except us. We believe that everything, no matter what it is, has spirit, even that which is inanimate. And we believe in regard to human life and other forms of living things upon this earth that when the time which you call death, we don't call that because we don't believe in death. Our word for death means the paying back. And at that time, the body simply pays back to our Mother the Earth that which it has received from her during the time that they were temporarily in this world. And there is spirit there. There is some spirit involved. It's a material type of the spirit. Then there is the spirit, which is the eternal part of an individual, a person, a plant, a flower, a rock, a tree, that which goes on forever, because we know that nothing ever ends. Everything always goes on. It may become, goes into another form, but it always goes on and on and on, a continuous life cycle. And we delineate that between that which materially ends and that which continues. That's where they got the idea that we believe in two forms.
There are several sorts of shamans in Anishinaabeg society, and you'll hear some discussions of each. Yesterday, Weston Labar talked about the sort of shaman which the French made most of, the sort that they called jongleurs, jugglers or conjurers. The Anishinaabeg word for that is jossakeet, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
They have a certain sort of specialty, don't they?
Yes, but I'm not going to say what I think you're trying to get me to say. I mean, yeah. They're entertainers. They really are. They're something like the old-fashioned Chautauqua. They can do everything, you know, sleight of hand tricks and all that sort of thing. They also very clever people. Never underestimate a jossakeet if you happen to meet one. They can read personality very well, and they can see, you know, they make very good psychiatrists. They can see what people need, and so they give it to them, and then the people give them lots of presents for telling them the things they wanted to hear. Anyway, you know, they do a few little tricks for attention, and then some of them are real charlatans, and they just out there for what they can get. And there are some that are very, really very good. I myself have seen shaking tent ceremonies that I couldn't imagine how it could possibly have happened. And I've seen others where the instance, a jossakeet call a great number of turtles, which they use for their familiar spirit. Now, you tell me how, even with training, maybe one turtle, yes, maybe two turtles, maybe 10 turtles, 100 and some? No way. Right out of the woods, you know. So some of them are very good. But I suspect that the majority of them are misused their calling. So.
You're a mashkiki.
That's right.
A mashkiki kwe, an herbalist.
That makes it female.
Yes.
Yeah. That's right.
And that is not simply a secular position, is it?
No, because one has, in order to treat the spirit, one must know things of the spirit. In order to use the spirits of other living things to help their brothers and sisters who need it, they must be acquainted with those spirits. Because, see, we believe that not only is there a chemical constituent in the plant which will help whatever the problem is, but we also believe that there is a spirit of that plant which can help the spirit which is in need.
You're also Midday.
That's right. I remember the Midday we went. And I'm not afraid to admit that I belong to the fifth degree. Most of our people will not admit to having gone any further than the fourth degree because I don't know whose fault it is, whether it's the fault of missionaries or how it ever happened. But nowadays, the implication of having gone beyond the fourth degree is that you are a witch of some kind. And so there's a tremendous number of Midday women who are all fourth degree.
And never any higher.
Never any higher.
Well, we're not going to be discussing.
Well, I hope you're going to say the name.
Well, I will. But I want to point out that I want you to say that. I'd like you to describe it a bit, but I'd also like to say...
Don't talk too much, in other words.
No. But I'd still like to say that we're not going to be discussing anything with Miss Cueto that is directly related to the Midday Waywin. I want to make that clear. We're not talking about the society itself. Now, I used a word, which is the white man's term. We call it the Grand Medicine Society, but what is it really?
Well, if one were to translate it literally, it would be something like the Society of Mysterious Doings.
Society of what?
Mysterious Doings. However, I never object when anybody calls it the Grand Medicine Society because I think that's good usage for white people to use. Yeah. Because it indicates, I really appreciate the term, it indicates the benefits or the reason why one would belong to the Grand Medicine Society. Because when one is initiated, he receives the, and this, I don't know why anthropologists never put it down. It irritates me a little. They put down all these funny little things like, you know, hocus pocus type of stuff, and then when it comes to the real nitty gritty, they just skip it completely. When one is initiated, he receives as a gift from every member of the group into which he is initiated one medicine. There's a little packet, and it's all done up, and all the different components of this medicine, and that gift is not intended that it would just be the package that one receives. It is symbolic because after the ceremony, one goes to the giver, the donor, and lays down a little sacred tobacco, and then that person will make arrangements for you to come and see them, at which time they will actually show you in detail how to gather the components of that medicine, how to prepare it, what proportions, how to make it into a medicine, and will teach you the songs and the prayers that go with it, and show you how the application is made. And that is repeated. When one becomes second degree, then every member of the organization gives you two medicines. So now you say there were 30 members, by that time you've got 90 medicines. You've got a lot of potential for healing there in your hands. Then the third degree, you get 3 from everybody. So you have 90 and 90. Fourth degree, you get 4 from everybody. By that time, some of them are having to bow out. They don't have any more to give you. So that's the real benefit of belonging to the Grand Medicine Society. And that is the real concern of the Grand Medicine Society.
There's also another kind of shaman called a Wabano, man of the East. What sort of functions do they fulfill? What do they do?
That was a little hard for me to answer. Just, I think from the short time I have had to read what anthropologists have written about the Wabano, it must be that in the times that they were writing, the Wabano functioned differently than they do now. Because now, people who adhere to the Wabano religion, and there are many of them, let's see how I explain it. All right. Wabano is to the midday weaving religion as, say, a storefront gospel mission might be to Christianity.
But they can be midday as well, can
they?
They
can be midday as well. I mean, that's like saying, you know, you can belong to the Gospelite mission and be a Christian too.
Yes. Mm.
Same sort of thing. And they just have a little different way of expressing it. And I was a little girl, I liked to watch the Wabano because they had real snappy songs. And they used to dance around, they used to throw fire around, and they could eat fire. And then one of the things they did to show their powers was they'd take hot boiling stones into their lips and that type of thing, you know. And I thought it was really exciting. And my grandfather, who was Midewewin, who sang very dignified chants through his nose, thought that their songs were too swingy and they did, you know, that kind of thing.
But he had a reason for that. He was Midewogema.
Okay.
It is.
Well, you know, it's the same sort of a thing, you know, like somebody who, say, a Presbyterian might look at the storefront gospel people, you know, it's the same type of thing.
Mide Ogema means?
Leader of the Midewewin.
So he was well up in the,
yes,
in the hierarchy.
Yes.
When you came on the stage earlier, you were wearing a stole with a lovely needlework pouch. Could we have the projector on, please? This is Ki Wedno Kwe, much as you see her today. Her in her ceremonial robes, with her fan, and with the stole, with the needlework pouch at the bottom. This is a close-up of the pouch itself.
You know what's remarkable about that pouch is that it isn't needlework. It's all done with the fingers. That's finger weaving. No needle.
I'm more impressed now than I was before by it.
Not even a bone needle. It was made by my great-great-grandmother.
Why don't you tell them how you came to get it and almost came not to get it?
You know, I'm not passionate about this. You should tell this. This is very bad Indian form to tell anything negative about one's immediate family.
She's going to lay it all on me.
No, I'll tell some other things, but that one, you know, I could be severely criticized for repeating it. If you think it's important, you tell it.
Well, I'm just liable to leave out a lot of the important details.
Oh, I'll correct it.
But the point was that Kiwenokwe's grand...
Great,
great, great, great... See, I told you I'd leave out the idea. Mm-hmm. Knew about its usage. Knew that its purpose was to contain ritual objects, primarily the Misquedo. And that this was one of these things that should be suppressed, at least destroyed if possible. Now, I've told the bad part. Why don't you tell about how it was recovered? That's good.
Well, you mean, what you're talking about the recovery? You mean how I got it, or
yes.
You mean how it happened to be saved instead of destroyed?
Yes, both things.
Well, it was sent to my mother to be given to me, and my mother, who very strongly believed that these things were all wrong, was going to burn it. And my father, the son of Nityogama, and also a very loyal husband, said, well, you know, if you burn it, people may see a little piece of it left, and they'll know what you've done, and you know how they'll talk about it. And besides, it was a gift, and it should have gift respect. So why don't you just wrap it up in tissue paper and put it in the box in the attic along with all the other things you saved? And so she did.
And you use it regularly now.
That's right.
Gordon mentioned in his introduction the scroll which Key has made for him. The Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, excuse me, used these birch bark scrolls in storytelling, but most of all in the religious processes. They consist of three general types of glyphs. The first is symbolic, a glyph which stands for a concept. The second type is a pictorial recounting of what happened in the legend, myth, or story, or song. And the third kind is rather like a map. I'll show you the scroll that he made in broad form before we just get into it specifically. And the reason we're not going into this to tell you how to make scrolls or how scrolls were made, but what the scroll says. That's the important part. We'll just describe a little bit so that you don't get confused what it looks like and how it goes. That happens to be an Anishinaabe war chief with his war bonnet. As a matter of fact, there was a war chief called Wasson, an Anishinaabe war chief.
Which immediately gave Watanabe stature among my people.
The scroll is arranged in this case very much like a book, with the central, because the birch bark is not long enough, it folds at the hinge like a book, although many scrolls are in fact scrolls, they're rolled and kept that way.
It is a device to keep them from cracking, then.
Yes. The glyphs range in three lines on each one of the two panels, the two major panels. We'll go through it in detail as he tells you the story of the scroll. But I'd just like to point out the three sorts of glyphs that you'll see that I mentioned before. The first one, since you won't hear me, since I don't have a mic, the first one will be a symbolic glyph. The second will be one in which a picture is essentially incised in the birch bark. And the third will be a map-like glyph. Say again? Key made this is, as Gordon said, a copy as Key remembers it from this woman, Ispakwe. So this scroll is not old. Key made it, how long ago? 2 years?
3 years ago.
Yes.
Three years.
But the scroll from which it was copied
was in fact much, much older. Now, Key did not make, say this now, Key did not make an effort to mimic precisely the characteristics of the old scrolls. These are her remembrances of it.
So I probably should tell them that at the time I made it, I had no knowledge at all of anthropology. Or anthropologist.
Your credit.
I was subsequently amazed at the science of anthropology and anthropologists. He just said, you know, could I make it? And I said, sure. He said, do it. So I did. I had no idea, you know, that anybody was going to study it and look over it carefully and all that sort of thing.
Okay, just let me go up there and do that.
So it was a symbol of accumulated knowledge, and heart can be used. You don't want me to go into it all. Those two together would say something like, surely this knowledge is correct, or it is true, or this is right. Symbolic sort of device that shows an Indian youth simply running with a giant mushroom.
This is the reverse side of the scroll.
Reverse side of the scroll. This is a map-like depiction.